Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Robert Czar, President of Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the current debate between Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders over single-payer health care. Anti-pipeline activist Hattie Nessel, who explains why she and her neighbors embarked on a three-day winter walk in opposition to a proposed frack gas pipeline in western Massachusetts. And Michelle Higgins of the groups Faith for Justice and the Organization for Black Struggle, who talks about the nationwide protest actions that were organized during the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Democracy is in full retreat in Tajikistan, the poorest nation in Central Asia, which borders Afghanistan, China, and Pakistan. President Emomali Rahmon, who took power in 1994, has banned the moderate opposition Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan and labeled it a terrorist organization as activists have fled the country. Now the pro-Rahmon parliament has honored the president as leader of the nation, effectively giving him immunity for life from any future criminal prosecution. Economic sanctions on Russia have also crippled Tajikistan, which relies on remittances sent back by Tajiks working there. Now, over 300,000 migrants have returned home with little prospect of finding a job. According to a new report by the International Crisis Group, Tajikistan is at risk of becoming a staging area for radical Islamists looking for a home base in Central Asia. The ruling elite in Dushanbe were shocked by the defection to ISIS of General Gumurod Kalimov, head of the Special Assignment Police Unit. Further, the 1997 peace agreement between President Rahmon and moderate Islamists has completely broken down. In the midst of the political crisis, a deputy defense minister affiliated with the opposition fled the country rather than face trumped-up charges against him of plotting a coup. Amidst the overheated anti-immigrant rhetoric from Republican presidential candidates Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, Latino voters in Iowa are mobilizing for the February 1st caucus. Unions and Hispanic groups are engaging with Democratic candidates and looking to build political power in the purple Midwestern state. Union meatpackers at JBS Swift & Company met recently in central Iowa to talk about the Democrats running for president and mobilizing 10,000 Latinos on caucus night. Christian Euclis of the League of Latin American Citizens in Iowa told the Guardian newspaper, "We have so much to lose if we don't participate. We have so much to lose if candidates like Trump think they can dehumanize and demoralize our community, all because they don't fear our voting power." Iowa's Latino population has grown rapidly as immigrants arrived to work in the state's meatpacking plants and established roots in cities like Des Moines. Latinos are now the largest ethnic minority in the Hawkeye State. Activist Maru Abarca, who is knocking on doors to boost Latino turnout for the February 1st Iowa caucuses, declared, "We are tired of sitting back and being underestimated." Minneapolis is home to a new innovative pilot project designed to break up the cycle of homelessness among young adults with children. Youth participants involved with the initiative, known as Heading Home Hennepin, have seen a 36% rise in individual income. According to the Christian Science Monitor, parents under the age of 25 with children are the most likely to enter a cycle of homelessness. Other adults often become homeless due to the loss of a job, but younger adults in their early 20s often lack life and job skills to support families. The Minneapolis Public Schools estimated 4,000 students became homeless in the last school year. Nationally, more than 2.5 million youths go homeless annually. Many homeless youth in Minneapolis find their way to a drop-in center at Youth Link. The agency hosts a hub of social services, offering assistance with basic needs like food and health care. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
One of the defining issues separating the two major candidates vying for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination is disagreement on the need to establish a single-payer healthcare system in the United States. While independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders advocates such a system, sometimes referred to as Medicare for All, his opponent, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, says the proposal would be too expensive for taxpayers and not politically viable. Clinton and her campaign have accused Senator Sanders of promoting a plan that would do away with the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, effectively end Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Program, and other government health care benefits. In response, Sanders asserts his proposal would provide universal health care for the first time in U.S. history, repairing the major deficiencies in Obamacare that has left 29 million Americans without health insurance and many more underinsured. The U.S., Sanders repeatedly reminds his audiences, is the only industrial nation in the world today without a universal health care system. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Robert Czar, president of the group Physicians for a National Health Program and a board-certified pediatrician at Unity Healthcare in Washington, D.C. Here, Dr. Czar assesses the validity of Hillary Clinton's criticisms of Sanders' advocacy of a single-payer system and the relative strengths and weaknesses of President Obama's Affordable Care Act.
Single-payer national health insurance, as it's described in a physician's proposal that was published in JAMA back in 2003, and as is largely represented in two pieces of legislation, H.R. 676, which is Conyers' bill, as well as Sanders' Senate companion bill, which is 1782, would take a program called Medicare that's been around, established since 1965, and improve it and expand it. In fact, the title of H.R. 676, which is Conyers' single-payer bill, it's called Expanded and Improved Medicare for All. So to say that there'd be any dismantling is simply not true. It would actually be building on what we have currently in this country, which is single-payer for Americans over the age 65. I think it's more accurate to say that we would take funds to pay for the programs that Hillary Clinton has listed, take that money and roll it into a Medicare fund. And by doing that, then you have enormous administrative savings. And it's through that administrative savings that you see at least $400 billion saved a year, which can then be a big part of to explain how we can provide every American, finally, with a national health insurance card, which means a very, very generous basket of benefits from birth to death. That's what really needs to be said to the American public. I wouldn't use the word dismantling. It's not quite capturing the essence of Medicare for All, which is taking a program that runs fairly efficiently. We're talking about an overhead of about, less than 3%, which is in huge contrast to private insurance companies, which runs in the double digits, often as high as 18%. So taking that efficiency of Medicare's administrative efficiency there and using it to provide care for everybody.
Dr. Robert Czar, Hillary Clinton basically places her bets on reforming and expanding the current Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, to get to a more inclusive system moving towards universal health care, whereas Bernie Sanders says we really have to bypass the current structure of the ACA. Is it possible to reform and expand the Affordable Care Act to move towards universal health care, or do we really have to move to an entirely different system, as Bernie Sanders claims?
Well, it's not really a matter of my opinion. It's a matter of science, and it's a matter of listening to data. So, I think at the end of the day, if someone says to you, we've got, more than two decades of really solid foundational health policy research that shows hands down that there is no way, no other way we know of in the world to provide health care from the day you're born to the day you die, give you a very, very generous basket of benefits and do it in a very efficient and cost-effective manner, and that single payer, it would be false and misguiding if I said anything else. Physicians for a National Health Program is, as you know, a nonpartisan organization, and being a nonprofit, we don't endorse candidates. We're about telling the truth, and I think that's why so much of the world looks to us as an example of where facts really lie. So this really has very little to do with my opinion, and it has to do with facts. And the facts will never change. The facts are that we cannot continue to rely on a system that depends on a for-profit driven industry whose main motive is profit for their shareholders. You know, we need to move to a system that is efficient and encourages quality, is equitable, and provides for every American without bankrupting the country and individuals for the years to come. So, you know, that's simply the truth. Now, whether we choose to believe that or not, that's one thing. But, you know, we're really an organization who's tasked with, analyzing data to guide sound healthcare policy. Politics is a whole other discussion, of which I am not an expert. But I can tell you from a health policy perspective, there are a few people in this country who would disagree with the facts.
Dr. Robert Saar, as we close here, what is your hope for the debate over single payer in this 2016 presidential election campaign?
Physicians like myself and the public at large are thrilled that we're talking about this again. The majority of physicians support the creation of national health insurance. So the docs are on board. We've had survey after survey of the American public who support expanding and improving Medicare. So, you know, my hope is that, you know, this kind of issue be raised again and again during the next few months so that we have a chance to educate and I hope also to activate, our population in this country to do something about this. Because there is a solution to our nightmare, and it's called single-payer national health insurance.
That was Dr. Robert Saar, president of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Learn more about the debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on the merits and cost of a single-payer healthcare system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When it comes to opposition to proposed frack gas pipelines across the country, one of the best organized grassroots movements is based in the hill towns of rural Northwest Massachusetts. For over a year, property owners, local officials, the president of the state senate, and major environmental groups have all intervened in the permitting process for a pipeline with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Opponents maintain that the Tennessee Pipeline Company's Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline isn't needed or wanted to bring frack gas from Pennsylvania through New York, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, which they say will be exported to eastern Canada. In November, Kinder Morgan, Tennessee Pipeline's parent company, filed information with FERC indicating the company may want to use a substantial percentage of the gas to feed a massive gas-powered electric power plant that could be built somewhere along the proposed pipeline route. More than 1,700 interveners have filed their opposition to the pipeline with FERC, which may be the largest number for any proposed pipeline. Hattie Nessel, who's 77 years old and a pipeline opponent, was struck with the idea of organizing a three-day walk over the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend from the site of a proposed gas compressor station in the town of Northfield to the site of a planned pipe storage facility 34 miles away in Plainfield. In less than a month, with no formal meetings or budget, and despite naysayers who doubted anyone would march for 3 days in mid-January's frigid temperatures, more than 100 people marched at least part of each day, from babies in strollers to octogenarians. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in the walk to learn firsthand from the mostly local residents about their concerns, and spoke with Hattie Nessel at the end of the second day of the walk. Here Nessel explains why she took on the project, and what defeating the pipeline will mean for residents and the environment of the area she calls home.
If you really read and study Martin Luther King's life and his thinking and his commitments, he didn't always do what was popular. He didn't always do what people thought he should do. He did what was some inner light guided him to do. He followed his inner light. And I just put this out to people because my inner light said we should take this 3-day walk to commemorate him and to fight the pipeline and put the word out there about the pipeline. Hundreds of people have walked. They've supported the walk. They've cooked for the walk. They're putting us up at night. Every need is met. It's just a beautiful explosion of people coming together, young children, young mothers, older people, whatever, to do this work to stop the pipeline. And I'm sure that Martin Luther King's vision would have included the destruction of the earth as a real human rights violation and a lack of democracy. And those were things that really were important to him.
The Kinder Morgan pipeline, just trace the path from where it enters Massachusetts and where it leaves and, you know, what people are doing to oppose it and why.
Yeah, first of all, it comes up from the fracked fields of Pennsylvania, the Marcellus Shale, and the fracking process is very devastating to people. So that's part of the problem. And it's devastating to the workers. They're inhaling all kinds of carcinogens and methane that's very bad for the environment. Wells have been destroyed. People are getting really sick around in Pennsylvania, which is where I'm originally from. And then it goes up through New York by pipe, and they want to come through Massachusetts with a pipe load of this fracked gas. So on many different levels, we don't want this gas. We have all kinds of laws and constitutional amendments that say that protected land, conserved land should be protected. It should not be destroyed. And this company is just in it for the profit. We would have to pay for it. We'd have to pay for the litigation, whatever was going on. Our housing values would be destroyed. But the worst thing is species habitats would be destroyed. Our waterways would be destroyed. Our forests would be cut down. We would no longer be the same area, a rural, beautiful, pristine area that we were if the pipeline were to come through.
So when you were walking the path of the pipeline, goes right over or right through a lot of land that's in conservation, and that's illegal, right?
Something like 1,000 parcels would be impacted. So we really want to stop the pipeline to avoid that kind of destruction. We value our lands. We value our quiet rural life. People are really very fraught over the idea that somebody could have an easement through their property very close to their house or their fields, their organic farms, their cow pastures, whatever. We also have a lot of legislators that are really with us. They live in these rural areas, several of them. And they listen to their constituents' concerns, and they are in there trying to stop it also. It's a very fraught process for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They have every right to just go right ahead and permit this application without a lot of information and a lot of specific information, they have a lot of outdated information. They submitted it with 30-year-old maps, which don't apply to our communities anymore. People are really upset about this. So there's a lot of activism in Massachusetts to stop this pipeline, and we might do it. We just might do it.
That was Hattie Nessel, organizer of the Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Walk to Stop the NED Pipeline in western Massachusetts. For more information on the pipeline protest, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past year and a half, tens of thousands of people from across the United States have participated in protests calling attention to and demanding action to stop unjustified police violence in communities of color. The Black Lives Matter movement was launched after the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City during the summer of 2014. The movement's relevancy is continually demonstrated, with frequent incidents of police misconduct now being captured on video recordings. The October 2014 Chicago police shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald exploded into a major scandal after it was revealed that video evidence, which clearly showed police use of unnecessary deadly force, was suppressed for over a year. The McDonald case has provoked calls for the resignation of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and other officials. The failure of a grand jury to indict the officers involved in the shooting death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland has triggered demands for a federal investigation into the young man's death. Rice was shot by a white police officer in November 2014, just 2 seconds after a squad car arrived at the scene, responding to a call that the boy was likely carrying a toy gun. Your reporter spoke with Michelle Higgins, director of the group Faith for Justice and an active member of the Organization for Black Struggle. Here she talks about the nationwide Reclaim MLK protest actions that were organized during the 2015 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. The actions were centered around the movement's three demands: divest from racist systems and invest in black communities, recapture community control, and establish alternative institutions.
The main idea, especially as we enter into Black Heritage Month from Dr. King's commemoration of his birthday, is this idea that the civil rights movement is somehow over, somehow that because we have achieved racism or discrimination as illegal broadly, federally, there's an assumption that discrimination no longer occurs. But Ella Baker herself, one of the greatest civil rights movement leaders, if not the mother of civil rights movement, Ella Baker said, once we get legislation passed, we're still not free yet. We're not free until we know that we have control over what happens in our communities. We're not free until institutions, until the government divests from building prisons and invests in building black futures. We're not free. And so the Reclaim MLK and the modern Black Lives Matter and Movement for Black Lives, those movements are actually a continuation of a civil rights struggle that never ended. The era of civil rights has not ended. In fact, Coretta Scott King herself said, generations, different generations, will struggle for freedom in their own way. And that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is, and that's what the broader network of movements for the dignity and value of all Black lives are striving towards. I mean, we face issues with specifically people of color who are transsexual, are abused and targeted, people of color who have committed past crimes, find that there is no opportunity for rehabilitation, real rehabilitation in their communities, people of color who are innocent and yet are still convicted and imprisoned without regard to the fact that when you're poor, you don't have access to excellent care from the law, to good defense attorneys. There's no consideration in our system that freedom, this actual releasing of enslaved people, making lynching illegal, all that did was change a law. We are now after making the laws effective by forcing people to admit that their hearts are still hard. And that is why we resist. We have to resist the efforts to keep peace, which is just telling us to be quiet, in order to make transformative change, which is demanding that we raise our voices, share our stories, and be accepted as citizens, as fellow citizens in this country.
Beautifully said. Thank you, Michelle. For our listeners who may not have heard a lot of the details about these protest actions, vigils, civil disobedience that took place around the country over this King holiday weekend, describe some of the actions for us.
Our partners in Chicago hosted a rally and a march specifically focusing on police brutality and crime. So corruption, punitive killings, especially killing of black people by law enforcement, recent cover-ups going on in Chicago were brought to light. The broad appeal that I have sensed from these actions is to shine a light on something that everybody hoped would remain covered up,
to shine a light on issues and corruption that people were, are begging citizens to leave invisible. We have to make it visible. And our commitment really is not to destroy a system that might have some good. We're not saying no one should ever be punished. Our commitment is to destroy the evils, to take down and restructure a system that has to be renewed if it's going to work. And we really can't develop a healthy trust in law enforcement unless and until law enforcement is ready to admit that they have to be held accountable. So it's been a very striking, a very important move in our partners around the country to see them say, we're going to continue this rallying cry, and we're going to continue to focus boldly on the brutality, corruption, and state-sanctioned killings that are going on in our cities around the country. And that was, in Chicago, a really excellent focus for right now. In St. Louis, our struggle has been not only with police brutality and corruption, but with drawing moderate, perhaps hesitant people from the sidelines into the movement. People who would click like on Facebook, who haven't stepped out of their houses to raise their voices in unity with people in this movement, with folks who are in the struggle. People who would say, I'm going to read this book, but I'm not quite ready to march hand in hand in certain sections of my city that I deem quote-unquote dangerous. We decided to do a movement that incorporated faith communities, activists, and protesters from all walks of life. We intentionally set out in the city of St. Louis to connect people who normally would not look each other in the eye and call one another friends. So our event was focused on reclaiming MLK by taking our neighborhoods and really challenging each other to behave more like family.
That was Michelle Higgins, director of the group Faith for Justice and an active member of the Organization for Black Struggle. Learn more about the groups active in the Black Lives Matter movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.